Welcome to the View My Seats podcast. I'm your host, John Lord. With me today to talk a little U.S. Open golf is the owner of golfnewsnet.com, Ryan Belangi. Ryan, what's going on today?
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm excellent. So the big story, Monday morning, the day after the 114th U.S. Open, is the big story Martin Kaymer or Pinehurst number two?
I think Donald Trump would tell you it's Pinehurst number two, but the real story is, I believe, Martin Kaymer, because he's won a second major championship. He validated all the work that he did to improve his game that took him from first in the world to 63rd in the world ranking. And now he finds himself as, while the ranking may not say it, the best golfer in the world right now as the winner of the Players and the U.S. Open. And all of a sudden, he's starting to show that potential that he showed in 2010 when he won the PGA and then ripped off a ton of wins in Europe around that time as well. And this is the guy I think people were expecting 4 years ago. And so that's why it should be a story, because if this continues, this guy could be the new face of golf. And I know we're all in the search for that. So at 29, Kaymer's got as many majors as Rory McIlroy does at 25 and seems to be exhibiting better form. So I think we got a little boat race on our hands here for who's going to be that young gun to carry us to the next generation once Tiger goes by the wayside.
I do definitely want to talk about Donald Trump and Pinehurst number two in general, but let's first talk about the big story, which is, as you said, Martin Kaymer. How good can Martin Kaymer be? And I guess my question is, the last time he made it to the top of his sport, he wasn't quite ready for it. He might have been too young. He might have had parts of his game that he wasn't comfortable with. I mean, the story's kind of famous now as far as he tried to retool his swing in order to fit Augusta National. And that really wreaked havoc with his game for a couple of years. And he's just now gotten back to what made him successful before. So what is it about Martin Kaymer that makes him so good? I mean, it was so clear that he was playing on a different level this past weekend at the U.S. Open. What is it about him that makes him perhaps the best golfer today?
Well, I think he seems to understand who he is and what he's playing for. And that's going to sound like a lot of hocus pocus, but at this level, everybody is really good technically speaking. They all know their swings. They all know how to get up and down. They all know how to make clutch putts, make birdies, and score with varying degrees of skill at each kind of skill set, but they all can do it. So I think that the biggest edge you can have at this stage of the game is confidence and belief in yourself and what you're doing, and understanding that what you're doing will lead to the right result if you stick with it. And that's what he's done these last few years. And he endured, obviously not playing very well the last few years, a 3-year winless drought, essentially, and hearing from all of us in the media that he was a one-hit wonder and is never going to be anything. And he believed in what he was doing, and it proved itself to work. And I think we're seeing the same thing now with Michelle Wee, kind of transitioning into the Women's Open a little bit, or touching on it for this week, also at Pinehurst. She believes in what she's doing. And I think for the first time in her, at least professional career, she's content with that. And that's really important. I think to be happy, be content, and be confident goes a long way in professional golf, because you kind of saw it with Eric Compton as well. Eric Compton has nothing to lose. I mean, he's on his third heart. He's found a way to get to every stage of the game just through grit and determination and belief that what he's doing is right. And it finally paid off for him, albeit in a distant second place. He was second place in the U.S. Open. And I don't think anybody ever saw that coming for Eric Compton either. So I think that's what these guys are doing. And Ricky Fowler, too, he believes in what he's doing with Butch Harmon, and he knows it's the right thing. It's breaking up what he did in his swing that was wrong and fixing with what's right. And there's your results there. He's one of two guys this year to finish in the top 10 in both majors. Jimmy Walker's the other. And you can kind of sense that trend as you go through each and every guy. They believe in what they're doing. They're happy with their life. And when they go to the golf course, there's nothing to get in the way of them playing good golf. And that's the secret.
What I took from watching the U.S. Open this week, and it was it really was never close. As soon as Keimer got off to those 65-65, those first two round starts. But what impresses me the most about Martin Keimer, beyond the shots he plays, is just his demeanor. You know, you hear analysts talk about the demeanor of golfers and how you have to take the ups with the downs. And maybe it's the German in him. Maybe it's Bernard Langer's influence. I don't know what it is, but for a 29-year-old dude, he seems incredibly composed out there.
Yeah, he's really got it together. And when he got himself into tight spots, he never looked like he was furrowing his brow or especially scared. That bogey putt that he made on Saturday on the fourth hole that prevented him from making a double or worse was really emblematic of the way that he played this week. He took the smart approach. He knew what he had to do, and he did it. And he believed the entire way that he was going to do it. And he took it down to the end where he knew he could do everything that he wanted to do if he just stuck with the game plan. And if you've got a lot of belief in your game and what you're doing in the game plan, executing it isn't that hard for these guys. It's that creep of doubt that comes in when the going gets tough that's the difference. And mentally, Keimer's really strong. So there's no reason for him, with the kind of athletic swing that he has, the short game he exhibited, the clutch timing of his putts this week, if he keeps this up for an extended period of time, and when I'm not talking months, I'm talking years, this guy's going to be an amazing Hall of Fame golfer.
He's already done enough in his short career to technically qualify.
To qualify!
As a Hall of Fame golfer. I mean, they ran something. I forget where it was, but they were talking about there are only a handful of European golfers who have won two or more majors. And I think that was it.
He's the first guy from continental Europe to win the U.S. Open. How crazy
is
that?
Yes. That is amazing. I can't believe.
There's a run on foreign-born players winning the U.S. Open, but for that to have never happened in 113
shocking.
Previous ones of these is pretty shocking.
It's very shocking. Yeah, I heard that and was totally surprised. So it's his demeanor. It's his precision, his athleticism. You mentioned earlier how this sport is grasping for stars, and perhaps Martin Keimer is one of those up-and-coming stars that golf will turn to. My question, though, is what makes him successful is his not just his skill, but his demeanor, the fact that he is on the surface so even-keeled, so unflappable. Does that strength also potentially work against him as far as becoming the top dog who people want to watch play golf, who people talk about playing golf, that really drives up interest in the sport? Is Martin Keimer ever going to move the needle?
No, I don't think so, because it looks like he barely has a pulse out there.
Right.
And one, as you said, as a competitor, that's a huge strength. We've seen it time and again where guys who are just stone cold looking out there just win and win and win, and then they never really gain the kind of acclaim that they could get if they showed off a little bit more, if they showboated more, if they showed a little bit more fire in the belly. But does it really matter in the end for Martin Keimer, with the money that it is out there in golf, to be such a huge star in Europe potentially, because he's going to be a rare breed for continental Europe golfers? Does it really matter whether or not he shows the emotion? I don't know that it does. I don't think it matters to him all that much. I think he just wants to be good at his craft, and whatever kind of fallout comes from that comes out from that. But golf kind of needs a guy who shows a little bit more than Keimer does most of the time on the course. But there were times out there when he did a little fist pump or a clap or a kind of bark to himself moment. Maybe not in that kind of Tiger level where he's yelling at himself and flipping clubs and all this stuff. But there was enough emotion there to kind of keep me connected to the guy. I didn't feel like he was a total robot out there, which is good. I mean, you kind of want a guy to show off at least a little bit, but maybe keep a little reserve.
Yeah, and it is unfair to ask him to be somebody who he is not. And as you're saying, he is comfortable with who he is. Clearly, that is the reason he is successful right now as a golfer. But he might not owe it to fans of the sport, but it certainly helps the sport when the best players are sometimes the most charismatic. And frankly, without Tiger, without Phil, the sport is going to need their best players to carry themselves with a bit more bravado and panache. And Keimer, this is certainly unfair. He doesn't really carry himself that way. And as far as I know, there's no salacious news in the back pages of German newspapers talking about him breaking up with a girlfriend 3 days after they sent out wedding invitations. So there's really no social media driven interest in Keimer, and like there would be in a McIlroy perhaps. And I think frankly that golf could probably use those type of headlines as well as an excellent golfer. Maybe Keimer's not the total package for what golf fans are looking for. And that's unfair to him, but the sport could use perhaps somebody a bit more dynamic.
Yeah, I think it could. I think also if Martin Keimer peeled off 80 PGA Tour wins in his career, nobody would care how much he smiles, because they would want to see a guy who's so good at his craft, who cares what he does the rest of the time. And I think that's why what Jack Nicklaus's appeal was. Not like he was all that effusive.
Charismatic, right.
Or charismatic. He's still not all that charismatic.
No.
But people have the lasting image of him in 86 with his son on the bag. That's what they remember as Jack Nicklaus. That wasn't really him until the late 70s and early 80s when he kind of saw the end coming. 86 was a total surprise. And so I think people appreciated Nicklaus because he was just so darn good. You couldn't ignore him. You just had to appreciate. You had to respect him. So you either can be admired and respected, feared and respected, feared and admired. I mean, you can have kind of three or four different word bank adjectives that you can have to be, have mass appeal. And I think if you're Keimer, if you become a guy who wins 5, 6, 7 major championships, you don't have to be gregarious and charismatic to do to be a marketing whiz. You can be a guy that just invokes fear and be intimidating. And I think that can work. It worked for Randy Johnson in Major League Baseball, and it can work for Martin Keimer in golf.
Well, what worked for Randy Johnson was the fact that he was 7 feet tall, and when he when he released a pitch, it was nearly by your head. Just ask John Kruk in the All-Star game. So there's really, Martin Keimer plays the way he did at the U.S. Open. There's no reason why he can't win the Open Championship in Liverpool and then the PGA Championship. He was that good. But the other thing that, going back to the original question that I had for you at the start, so much of the discussion this weekend was about the golf course itself. What kind of a factor do you think that played in the quality of play at the U.S. Open? I know that if you removed Martin Keimer from the U.S. Open, that was an incredibly competitive tournament.
Yeah, if there's no Martin Keimer, we have a Monday playoff between Eric Compton and Ricky Fowler.
Right. And then a score of golfers that were grouped around 1 over, 2 over, 3 4. So it played like a traditional U.S. Open course, but you just heard a lot of people griping about the conditions. And mind you, these people were not the players. These people were viewers. And certainly the most, let's not call him famous, notorious,
yeah,
golf expert to chime in was Donald Trump, who had a few choice words about what Pinehurst looks like and how it's not suitable to be a U.S. Open venue. And we all understand that that's just sour grapes because he wants a U.S. Open. And isn't he getting a PGA championship?
Yeah, and I think that's partly in part why he bitched about the U.S. Open setup and having Pinehurst number two, because the USGA pretty much said to him, well, we don't think you're fit for a U.S. Open, but the PGA Championship and the PGA of America are trying to build an identity and be a little bit different and kind of think outside the box. And I hate to say it, but Donald Trump is outside the box thinking as far as golf is concerned.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they create the relationship with him.
I mean, the players were unanimous in their praise of Pinehurst. That what I heard from players on Twitter and after the U.S. Open was that the course allowed you to play your game. You know, it was the fairways were wide, there wasn't any rough, and you could kind of be creative around the greens, and it was I heard a lot of people calling it a fair test of golf. And from the fans' perspective, it really did look different, and I frankly liked it. I think sometimes we fall into this this homogenous, you know, what all golf courses are supposed to look like in the States. And frankly, I liked the fact that it had burned out edges and native waste areas. I thought it looked cool and it looked fun to play. What did you think?
I played it 3 years ago when the kind of public unveiling of the redesign happened after the 2011 Masters. And I was just blown away by how different it was from any kind of golf I had ever played. And it was an embrace of the topography, the geography, the plant life. That's what good golf course design is, in my opinion. And people are free to disagree. But the reality is, golf is heading in a direction where the world is heading in terms of environmentalism, in terms of limited resources, limited natural resources, climate change, where golf courses are going to be able to survive in the bottom line if they adapt to the geography and plant life in which they live. No more of this green everywhere, lush rough, lots of fertilizer, lots of water. That's just not a reality. It's not going to be 20 years from now. So unless you're at a really high-end club that has its own water supply, kind of like what Donald Trump has at a lot of places. So no wonder Donald Trump loves everywhere. He's the guy who can afford to do it.
He bought an aquifer.
Yeah, and I think that the statement the USGA made this week, and they're going to make next year at Chambers Bay, is that this is the future of golf. This is what's fun. Options are fun. Choices are fun. Angles are fun. And you can still protect par without a hint of rough in 40-yard wide fairways. And that's what they did. They did a brilliant job of protecting par. Now, it took them getting it to the edge of playable on Saturday to do it. And they could have probably done the same thing on Sunday and put everybody over par except Keimer. But they kind of held some restraint. I think that it was a great championship setup. They did, with a few mistakes on some of the drivable holes and a couple of pin placements, they were great. And I hope the women get the same kind of experience this week, because I think then that validates the choice to have it there for consecutive weeks. I'm just hoping that the conditions hold up just as well for them.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that in a second as far as being on the edge of playable with the U.S. Women's Open coming up this week. But before that, we go there, I really do hope that more municipal courses around the country will look at Pinehurst and say, with a little creativity, with a little love and care, we can do that at our course. We can make our course much more, I don't want to say aesthetically pleasing, but we can make it more accessible to all sorts of different types of golfers by opening it up, by maybe not growing out the rough as much, by using less water, which I think, as you said, will be important for more golf courses to do moving forward just because of the scarcity of natural resources. So I hope that a lot of local municipal courses looked at this U.S. Open at Pinehurst and said, you know what, that's how we're going to differentiate ourselves. That's what we're going to do moving forward.
I hope this was a wake-up call. I really do. Because, and not only for course owners and operators, because that's one thing unto itself. I think they kind of see the benefit, but their fear is that it'll turn off players who have grown accustomed to seeing on TV golf courses that are lush, green, deep rough, fast greens, all of this stuff that the PGA Tour guys get because they play the best manicured courses in the world. And when they don't see a modicum of that, when they tee it up, they get upset. They walk away. They don't want to play that course anymore. So hopefully this U.S. Open may be inspired in some people that playing golf that looks like this is fun. It's different. It's not for everybody. It's not for every course. It's not for every geography. But that if you embrace what's around you instead of kind of trying to pigeonhole a golf course into a geography, that it can still be a lot of fun and challenging and rewarding.
Yeah, those people you just described, those that complain about the conditions of a course unless they look like it does on TV, You're talking about the 1% of this country. And if the sport of golf is going to survive, it needs to reach out and get to the other 99. The 1% will always play golf. It's the 99% that is losing interest. And so if, let's just say, you don't irrigate your course as much, or you change the layout, maybe you lower costs there, who knows? And maybe you can, you know, make golf more affordable. Maybe you can, instead of just charging 18, you can play 9 whenever you want during the day. That's the kind of stuff that's going to help the game of golf grow moving forward. And, you know, I'd like to think that if the USGA is really interested in that, which hopefully they are, Pinehurst was a statement.
And I think so. And I think part of it is also that the golf industry does a terrible job of talking about how affordable playing golf actually is. Green fees are really pretty low in this country. I mean, if you look across the board, because there is just so much supply. There's over 15,000 golf facilities in this country, and so many of them have 18 hole rates that are $20 or less. I mean, it's incredible. But because ownership is so fractured, because my employer, Billy Casper Golf, is the largest operator or owner in the U.S., they own or operate 170 courses. That's a little over 1% of golf courses in the U.S., and they're the biggest, which makes it really hard to have a unified message about playing golf, its affordability, how golf courses should look and play and feel. That's really a tough problem for golf. And its communication problem is so deep, it's almost hard to imagine them digging themselves out of it. Because, like you said, USGA obviously stands for golf. Golf growth, golf membership, playing golf. Every year they have a new campaign. It was While We're Young. Now it's Play 9. I forget what the hell it was before that. There's Tee It Forward. How many campaigns can you have? And it feels like they don't give it enough time to develop. They just kind of say, well, nobody played any more rounds this year, so I guess we'll try a new one.
And yeah, it's a bunch of – go ahead.
It's just manure. And ultimately, that's not – and I did something for my website recently on kind of golf's demographic problem. That's the sports issue. It has several, but golf is a countercultural game if you think about it, because people are moving towards cities. Golf courses are not in cities. There are 50% more players per course in urban environments than suburban or exurban environments, which is ridiculous. It means there's not enough golf to go around in the city where people want to live. It's not affordable enough in the city where people want to live. It's not accessible by public transportation where people want to live. So we've got that problem for young people. And then on the tail end of it, golf banked on the growth of golf thanks to the baby boomer generation playing as much golf as their parents did when they retired. And that just isn't the case because they work longer. They've got other stuff to do. They've got a lot of debt. They've got kids who still live in their house. So the amount of money they spend and the amount of time they commit to playing golf is less. And that gamble didn't work out for golf, and it didn't work out for the real estate industry, which is in large part a contributor to why we got into this great recession in the first place, because real estate developers over-leveraged on things like golf real estate development, thinking that they could charge a premium in a marketplace that was thriving. And they were wrong. And now we're starting to see that reset take shape, not only in terms of the supply of golf courses, but also the people who demand it. And until that kind of shakes out, I think all of this stuff about trying to get more golfers, new golfers, guys who might play once, twice a year, it's just not going to work, because we're still, even though golf rates, green fees, are more affordable than ever compared to inflation, the issue is I'm still asking you, if you're a new golfer, to pay $1,000 for a set of clubs. And that's a ridiculous ask if you want somebody to take up your game and give it a try. And I've never seen from a manufacturer, from an equipment maker, from this hack golf thing that's basically a tailor-made golf initiative, the idea of having cheaper equipment that gets people to play the game. And if they don't, if that doesn't come, if there's not a system for that to encourage that, then I just don't see how golf can grow with young people who are going to be burdened with taking care of the baby boomer generation, with their own massive debt and their inability to save money. It just doesn't add up. I mean, it's a big demographic problem. It's not a sport problem at this point.
I hope there was a book publisher listening, because there is a tremendous story waiting to be told as far as the reason for the financial collapse of 2008. Forget about the housing bubble. It was the golf course bubble.
It really was. And
it's a that's a fantastic angle. I'm sure that with more research and perhaps more time that story could be told in full. The accessibility of golf, the cost of golf. Okay, so you say it's overblown. It's more affordable to play golf than we realize, although I would argue that not where we live in the Northeast Corridor, it's not. But perhaps in other parts of the country, it is. But when you talk about the USGA and these marketing campaigns and their new one is, was it While We're Young or?
Oh, it's Play 9 now instead of. It used play to be nine. Play faster. They realized people weren't playing faster, so they said just play less. And
yeah,
faster.
Yeah. You know,
next year will be don't play at all.
Don't play at all. But it got me thinking that you know the people that are responsible for these advertising campaigns are not the target audience. So therefore, when they come up with new initiatives, they're oftentimes misguided because they don't understand the challenges facing the people that are actually playing golf. So that's clearly that they got a bunch of people in the room who are not struggling to overcome obstacles with playing golf, and they came up with these new campaigns. And, yeah, that sounds good. Let's throw a bunch of stuff on a whiteboard, see if it works, see if it sticks this time.
And the thing I come back to with young people and getting them to play, because old people will eventually play golf. It just kind of works itself out. But if you want to get young people to play golf, get them started early and spending early and hooked early. I always go back to working at a driving range where I worked when I was a teenager. And people would come in on a Friday night, some dude who's wearing a tank top and his girlfriend, he's trying to impress his girlfriend, and they would rent two drivers and go hit 100 balls, and they'd spend like $20 between the balls and whatever other crap they were going to buy, ice cream and stuff like that. And they were terrible, but they came back because it didn't cost them anything to show up equipment-wise, and that's the thing I feel like golf is missing.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make sense for somebody who plays once or twice a year to own a really nice set of modern. If they're going to make that investment in the game, then they're going to want to play more. If they don't want to play more, they're not going to make that investment. And that kind of seems to be the missing piece here. It really is a kind of startup cost issue for people to get involved with golf because you also have to take lessons. You got to learn how to play, and that costs you several hundred bucks. So all in, just to start playing respectable golf on a course, costs you probably about $1,400. That sounds like a terrible investment for somebody who can barely pay their electric bill.
You ought to be able to do something with golf clubs like a timeshare, like a condominium somewhere in the Bahamas. You ought to be able to do like something where you say, for 2 weeks out of the year, I get this nice set of golf clubs, and then the rest of the year I do not have access to them while someone else does.
Timeshare golf equipment. Along with kind of like the Uber for golf clubs. Where
there you go.
They're at the course when you need them and when you want them and what clubs you need to play, and then when they're done, they come and get the clubs and you go home. That would be perfect. I mean, it's a bike share almost. Like
We're just full of free ideas between the book idea for the financial collapse of 2008 and the Uber for golf clubs. People listening, there you go. There's your free advice for how to be an entrepreneur.
Well, if you just rename the podcast the Seven Figures Podcast, not only will more people listen, but they are going to get these great multi-million-dollar ideas that we are just too lazy to go ahead and implement.
We're not going to do anything about Uber for golf, are we?
I might start a website, but yeah. Do the actual hard work. No way.
Register that domain now. Okay, last question before we go. Was it fair to play the men's open the week before the women's open? And do you think that the women will get Pinehurst at its best this week?
I think they'll still get a good Pinehurst. I'll be very curious to know what they use in terms of pin positions. Because they're only probably six or seven on any one green. So they're going to have some potential repeats, at least very close to repeats. I think because the way Pinehurst is maintained, you're not going to notice that big of a difference in terms of the foot traffic that you would see otherwise at other venues. It would become so much more obvious on television. There's probably six or seven different holes on the course where the driving area could be approximately the same for the men and the women, the way they set it up. That could be a problem just with divots and divot replacement, but we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, the card is never the same as what you see from the team, what they set up each day. But I think they're still going to get a really good test, and I still think they're going to get a really good golf course. My question is, will people show up to see it? Because there's got to be nothing more deflating than seeing those filled grandstands on Sunday at the 72nd hole for Keimer to win, and if they're half-filled for whoever wins the U.S. Women's Open this weekend, it's going to look kind of crummy.
Yeah, yeah, that would certainly be a downer for a lot of the women who were actually watching on the course, watching that final round, and remarked at how cool it was to see these stands filled for the men's U.S. Open. Ryan Blangy, the owner of GolfNewsNet.com. You have anything to plug this week, Ryan? What's coming up on the site this week? Any good stuff? Any morsels for the week?
Nothing especially planned for the week, although we do have some fun announcements coming in terms of podcasting, golf radio. We'll talk about that in the next couple of weeks. And we'll do a bunch of follow-up on the U.S. Women's Open this week as it unfolds and kind of do some comparison pieces between how the men's side was set up versus the women and see how it plays out. But we'll focus a little bit on Marty Keimer this week, get to know the guy a little bit better, because you might want to start remembering the name if he keeps playing like this.
Hey, maybe that's what he needs to do in order to increase his appeal, is instead of being Martin Keimer, he should be Marty Keimer.
I'm all for it, because something's got to change so he doesn't sound like a robot.
I think we can all get on board with a Marty Keimer.
I like Marty, yeah.
All right, Ryan, thanks a lot for the time.
Thanks, John.
Talk to you soon.
All right.